Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of June. Yesterday, the Supreme Court invalidated three provisions of Arizona's immigration law kept in place for now, perhaps waiting to see how it's implemented. The provision which allows the state to require police officers to enforce immigration laws, the papers please provision. We'll be talking about the key provisions of the Arizona law that were struck down, why the papers please provision was kept in the law this hour of the program, and we'll also hear how you and others have responded to what the Supreme Court did. Later this hour, also yesterday, the Supreme Court made a decision on Montana's century-old ban on corporate spending that supports or opposes political candidates, essentially saying that they have to follow Citizens United and that the Supreme Court at no time soon will consider reconsidering Citizens United. So that's our lineup for the first hour of the program today. And you can be sure that on Thursday of this week, we will be looking at the affordable health care ruling by the Supreme Court, which is coming down on Thursday. You're welcome to join this conversation. Always, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guest, Professor Bill Hing, professor of law at the University of San Francisco Law School, author of many publications on immigration policy and race relations, including Ethical Borders, NAFTA, Globalization and Mexican Immigration, and Deporting Our Souls, Morality, Values, and Immigration Policy. Professor Bill Hing, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Let's start with what is the most controversial provision in Arizona's law that the Supreme Court let stand. Why did they let stand the papers please provision, and should they have?
Well, I believe that the court allowed it to stand because they felt that there was not enough information yet on how the law would be implemented. Basically, what the law provides is that whenever a local or state law enforcement official stops someone who they, quote-unquote, have reasonable suspicion is undocumented, that they can ask questions about that person's status. And what the court said was that the lower courts in Arizona have yet to construe what the law means. So if the lower courts say that law enforcement officials can detain someone for a lengthy period of time under that provision, the Supreme Court said that would be a problem. But then the court said, on the other hand, if the Arizona courts say that this has to be a very, very temporary inquiry, then the Supreme Court said that that would not be a problem. Keep this in mind, Ms. Dunn, that this provision actually was modified after it was first passed. After this provision was first passed, there were serious charges that it would invite racial profiling. So the Arizona legislature immediately changed the wording that essentially said that police officers are not to engage in racial profiling, that they would follow the Constitution. And so it's been very carefully crafted, and the Supreme Court probably decided to take the safe road here and say, well, let's see how it's implemented before we make a final judgment on whether or not it's constitutional.
Do you think there's any way to implement this without doing racial profiling?
Well, That's the million-dollar question. It's going to be difficult. They gave a couple of examples in the decision. One, somebody who's stopped for jaywalking, and another person who is stopped for driving under the influence. And in both examples that they gave, the court said that the Arizona police have to be very, very careful. If someone has a valid driver's license, they've got to let them go under the law. And but if there's something else that's said or done, then it's going to be very difficult to implement without racial profiling. And I think what's going to happen is that when when somebody gets arrested under this law, once it gets implemented in the next few days, there's going to be a lawsuit by the first person of color
right.
that is arrested, and then we'll see what the basis was of the arrest.
And did the Supreme Court, in its wording yesterday, make it clear that they would look at that provision in the law should racial profiling occur, or did they not say anything regarding that?
They really didn't use the word racial profiling. They, at oral argument a couple of months ago, the Justice Roberts and the U.S. government attorney addressed that immediately and said, we're not talking about racial profiling, correct? And the U.S. government said, we're not talking about racial profiling. And so they studiously avoided that. But you can be darn sure that, again, once an arrest is made under this provision, that issue is going to be raised.
Mm-hmm. How do you reach a decision, and we'll look at the other parts of their decision now, where you have Governor Jan Brewer essentially saying she's happy with the decision, and you have President Obama saying that he's pleased that the court struck down some of the law's key provision. Is everybody equally happy?
You know, that's what the news reports, and I think that Governor Brewer cannot be that happy, because the main provisions of the law, and I actually don't consider this the main provision of the law. The main provision of the law, laws were thrown out, the ones where Arizona tried to enact its own immigration crimes, and also the provision which ordered police officers to help enforce immigration laws by just going out and looking for people that were deportable, having nothing to do with Arizona laws. Those were all thrown out, and I cannot believe that Governor Brewer is happy that those provisions were thrown out.
And what about the other states that have enacted similar laws? Do they just do nothing with those laws now, or are they off their books?
Well, they're not automatically off their books, and that's a very good question, because we have Alabama that has provisions that go beyond Arizona, Utah, Mississippi. There are ordinances in Pennsylvania, local ordinances that are all wrapped up in the court, in different courts right now. And so what those different federal courts have to now do is compare what is in those other copycat laws with what the Supreme Court said. And if those courts think that that the laws that are in Alabama or Pennsylvania or Colorado are similar, then those courts will invalidate those provisions as well. However, if there are differences, then those may have to wait another day of reaching the Supreme Court on their own. For example, in Alabama, there's a provision that requires school children to demonstrate, to bring in information about their family's immigration backgrounds. And Alabama is saying that's just for record-keeping purposes. And the challengers are saying, well, that's to intimidate and to regulate immigration. And if that provision is construed as regulating immigration, then it's going to have a problem. But if that's construed as merely record-keeping, then that provision will live to see another day.
So what the Supreme Court did yesterday, in essence, was to make it clear that immigration law is a federal responsibility?
That's right. That when it comes to passing laws, especially when it comes to passing laws that make it a crime that relate to immigration status, that's clearly within the boundaries only of the federal Congress to enact those laws. That's one part. Then the other part that was very innovative from the U.S. government's perspective is that the U.S. government argued that when it comes to enforcement, that there's a federal plan for enforcement, and that allowing different states to contribute to that plan somehow, or to have their own immigration plan, that would throw off the federal plan. And the Supreme Court actually bought that argument when it came to Section 6 of the Arizona law, which, as I alluded to a little while ago, would have allowed state police officers to basically go out and hunt for undocumented immigrants. And the Supreme Court said, no, you cannot just on your own go out and help enforce immigration laws. That would throw off the federal scheme. So when it comes to state law enforcement officials, the Supreme Court said, you can only engage in this if you're a state official, if you've entered into a partnership that's legitimate with the U.S. government.
Hmm. And what does that mean? What's that partnership?
Well, there's actually a provision in the federal immigration laws. It's under Section 287G of the immigration laws where you actually, sheriffs often enter into these contractual agreements with ICE to help determine whether or not an arrested person is deportable or not. The most infamous example of that happens to come out of Arizona. Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Maricopa County, he actually had that kind of contract, but then he went beyond it, and the U.S. government has canceled his contract. But throughout the United States, there are those types of agreements. And, in fact, there's money that transfers hands. The U.S. government actually pays many of these sheriff's departments to help hold people and to determine whether or not they're deportable. And so that's the example that the Supreme Court gave, that if you want to help out, well, then enter into one of these arrangements with the federal government.
I read somewhere that aforementioned sheriff arrested a six-year-old girl last week. Is that true or not?
Well, I read allegations of that as well. And you know, he claims to be the toughest sheriff in America, and he definitely has taken it upon himself to be a one-person immigration service, and that's what's gotten him into trouble. The U.S. government has brought civil rights actions against him.
We welcome phone calls. We're talking about the decision concerning Montana and campaign reform that they did over 100 years ago, that because of Citizens United was ruled invalidated yesterday by the Supreme Court. That's the second half hour. So if you would like to talk about the Supreme Court's decision on Arizona's SB 1070, we would like very much to hear from you. So do it soon, can you? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, or you can leave messages on the Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Joel Stein will be joining us, columnist for Time Magazine, and he's written a very funny book, Man Made: A Stupid Quest for Masculinity. When he and his wife were having a son, he realized that he had to learn a little bit more about masculinity because he didn't consider himself a particularly masculine guy. So he did all of these things, and it's funny. It's a funny, and it's a poignant story as well. So that's coming up, hour number two. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Bill Hing, professor of law at the University of San Francisco Law School, is our guest as we look at the Supreme Court decision yesterday on immigration. Matt in Rice Lake, our first caller. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I guess I got a question for your guest. Now that the Supreme Court struck down the Arizona law, what is Arizona supposed to do to control a problem of this nature? I mean, obviously, the murders, you can't just go talk to a drug lord and say, hey, can you stop that? What are they supposed to do?
Well, okay, this had nothing to do with drug trafficking, okay? But you're absolutely right that what the Supreme Court reminded everyone, and the president and Governor Brewer made similar statements yesterday, is that there is definitely a need for comprehensive immigration reform. And part of the issue is, what do we do with the estimated 10 to 11 undocumented immigrants in the United States? And year after year, there's been more money put into enforcement. And yet, until the recent recession, which explains the fact that there's been a decline in undocumented immigration to the United States, that there's nothing else has been done. And so In a way, I think the Supreme Court decision is good, that it puts pressure on Congress to finally get together and do something comprehensively, which may not just deal with more money at the border, but visa reform, employment reform for possible guest workers, reform of the deportation laws, that type of thing. So that's been left on the back burner since before September 11th, 2001, the last time that we came very, very close to passing immigration reform.
Do you think there's any chance that Congress is going to take this up anytime soon? Talk about a federal responsibility. It is their responsibility to make sure that the system works well, isn't it?
I agree with you wholeheartedly, Ms. Dunn. This is a federal responsibility, and the Supreme Court made it very clear yesterday that that's what's happening. Unfortunately, we're in an election year, and what you saw just a week or so ago when President Obama made an announcement that DREAM Act students would not be deported, and then Senator Rubio backing off of his DREAM Act proposal, being upset at what the president did. Unfortunately, that's what we're going to see over the next few months until mm-hmm. November, and the earliest that I think we're going to see serious talk of reform is post the fall election.
What did you make of, this was mentioned quite a bit in analysis of the Supreme Court's delivery of statements yesterday, Justice Scalia, his summary was described as a fiery summary of his dissent, saying that Arizona's own sovereignty as a state makes it entitled to impose additional penalties and consequences for violations of the federal immigration laws because it is entitled to have its own immigration laws. Obviously, a view that was not endorsed by the majority of the court. But why do you think he really was vociferous in his statements?
Well, you know, Justice Scalia is very well known for those types of fiery statements, especially in his dissenting opinions. And I think he was expressing the frustration that states have over issues such as immigration challenges. And the problem with his statement, as you said, is it's not the majority opinion. And this goes way back historically at a time when, for example, there were anti-Chinese laws historically in places like San Francisco, ironically, where there's a mayor who's of Chinese-American descent now. And the Supreme Court has long held, since those state and local attempts to regulate immigration, that immigration regulation is within the federal bailiwick, and that we just cannot have 50 different immigration laws, and that states had to give up that right to control immigration when we became the United States in the 1700s. And so it may be that Justice Scalia's frustrations represent how states feel about issues such as immigration, but it's not the federal system.
But then he went on and criticized the president rather directly for what you were just talking about, the DREAM Act students not being deported. What was that all about?
Well, it's about priorities. If you're to listen to President Obama's point of view, that they've got, that ICE has its hands full, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement has its hands full, and that they want to concentrate on immigrants who have committed serious crimes, and it's like any other enforcement office, they get to pick and choose what they concentrate on, and they're concentrating on serious criminals. And but again, that's pretty important to the part of the law that was not struck down yesterday, because what the government is arguing is that we don't need to know when somebody stopped for a traffic violation or jaywalking is undocumented, because the chances are we're probably not going to deport that person anyway. And so let us figure out who's deportable or not. But that's what Justice Scalia's criticism is that immigration laws are immigration laws, and if somebody's violating the laws, that they should be removed. And the tension is that Obama's administration and DHS, they're saying, no, we get to decide what our priorities are.
Mm-hmm. And what did you make of the, it was almost poetic in a way, of Justice Kennedy talking about the history of the United States, part made of the stories, talents, and lasting contributions to those who crossed oceans and deserts to come here. I mean, it is the American story, and it is quite a story.
I was very, very surprised to see that in the decision. And I think it was apt. He's reminding us that we are a nation of immigrants. And I remember, and I'm sure you know this, you understand this as well. When you go into elementary school textbooks, we're led to believe that we're a nation of immigrants. And he was reminding us of the fact that we may be talking about undocumented immigrants, but the vast majority of non-citizens who come to the United States are hardworking, law-abiding people, and we shouldn't forget that because they've contributed immensely to the social and economic fabric of the country. So I thought it was a nice touch.
Yeah. We have time for a couple more phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. We're looking at the Supreme Court's decision on Arizona SB 1070, striking down three provisions of the law, keeping, seeing how it will play out in actual practice, the provision which allows the state to require police officers to enforce immigration laws, known as the Papers, Please provision. What do you think? We have a couple minutes to take your calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And after those couple minutes, we'll move into the court's decision on Montana's century-old ban on corporate spending that supports or opposes political candidates. If you were living in Arizona right now and you were in the country, you'd been here for a long period of time, but you were not here legally, what would you think about what the Supreme Court did yesterday, Professor Hing?
Well, you know, it just happens that I am from Arizona and I travel there often. And I think that folks are relieved, but they're also frustrated because of the absence of reform. And there is an argument to be made that we're not going to be able to spend billions of dollars rounding up undocumented immigrants, and that these are hardworking people that are, the vast majority are not criminals, and they're hoping that they be given a pathway, not automatic U.S. citizenship, but a pathway to come out of the shadows and to work and have their taxes recognized, which they continue to pay. And they're just like any other immigrant in the past, and that they're trying to do well by their families. And their lives have been controlled by globalization and what's happening with respect to NAFTA and other phenomena that are out of their hands.
So does this make them more likely to come out of the shadows or less likely?
Well, you know, I think that they're not going to be coming out of the shadows and shouting and screaming and that they're undocumented and they demand a right to stay here, but their lives will be allowed to operate more smoothly and without so much tension, without this kind of oversight.
Sig in River Falls. Hi, Sig.
Hi. I'm wondering if the professor has a comment about why the minority is so obsessed with states' rights, Clarence, etc.
Well, this goes on. This goes back to the concept of what's called federalism. Should states be allowed to do what they want to do? And the Supreme Court has been very clear that that when it comes to national issues, the states have to concede that there needs to be national guidance on certain issues, and immigration is one of them. And you'll see when we get to the healthcare issue later on in the week that they might look at that differently, that that may be something that states have reserved their power to do. And so the minority in the Arizona immigration case, it gave them an opportunity to complain that that states ought to be deferred to more often. And that's going to be an issue that's with us forever. That's one of the major tensions in U.S. constitutional law. And it depends on the issue and whether or not it makes more sense for guidance to be done federally rather than state by state.
And finally, I read an interesting piece yesterday that if you look at the oral arguments before the Supreme Court on Arizona's immigration law, a lot of people were saying, holy Toledo, this is not good for the administration. They're going to keep in place all of the Arizona law provisions. And the writer was looking ahead to the health care decisions, which will come up on Thursday. And there were similar kinds of oral arguments with the members of the court appearing to not favor the government. Is there anything to that, do you think, or not?
You know, I think there's a lot to that. In the sense that the oral arguments looked very bad for the administration in the immigration case, and it looked very bad in the health care arguments as well. Yet there was something about the values in the decision that brought Justice Roberts to the side of striking down the immigration law, that there's something bigger at stake here. And that clause that we talked about, that paragraph that you talked about in terms of reminding us that we're a nation of immigrants, I actually think that was a reflection of Justice Kennedy and Justice Roberts. And Justice Roberts, as the Chief Justice, he got to assign who wrote that decision yesterday.
Oh.
So he assigned that to Justice Kennedy. And I'm very confident that Justice Roberts wanted that kind of theme, reminding people that we're a nation of immigrants, in spite of how the oral arguments went. So that means that on health care, that he may be, this may be a sign of what's happening in healthcare too, that maybe he's thinking more broadly, and I suspect if they uphold healthcare, that Justice Roberts is going to write that opinion. He may be saving the best for last in terms of his views.
Hmm. Well, you are very interesting. Thank you so much for being with us on this day after the important decision. I appreciate
it. You're very
welcome. Our guest this half hour, Professor Bill Hing. He's a professor of law at the University of San Francisco School of Law, and he's author of Deporting Our Souls, Morality, Values, and Immigration Policy, and Ethical Borders, NAFTA, Globalization, and Mexican Migration. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Supreme Court, I found this to be a fascinating decision as well, and what's been going on in Montana has been really interesting. Yesterday, in American Tradition Partnership v. Bullock, the Supreme Court reversed an earlier Montana Supreme Court ruling and held that the Montana restriction on independent campaign expenditures was unconstitutional in violation of the First Amendment speech clause. It affirms the court's commitment to Citizens United. Restrictions on independent electioneering expenditures violates the First Amendment, even though we've seen some of the results of Citizens United. And it means that the court will allow no breathing room for regulation of independent electioneering expenditures, and that the court is not in the mood to reconsider Citizens United anytime soon. Talking about this ruling by the court is Professor Stephen Schwinn, associate professor at the John Marshall Law School. He's also taught at the University of Maryland and George Washington, practiced full-time in the office of the general counsel at the Peace Corps. He's an active practitioner, litigates cases pro bono in federal courts, and teaches constitutional law, comparative constitutional law, and human rights and lawyering skills. Professor Stephen Schwinn, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't think too many people knew about what was going on in Montana. Can you give us just a brief background here? They thought evidently there was a lot of corruption and money and politics, and so they passed their own law a long time ago.
Yes, it's true. And the court, the Montana Supreme Court, actually goes to great lengths, sort of eye-popping lengths in its opinion, to recount this history of really remarkable corruption in the state of Montana that its expenditure limit and restriction was aimed at.
And when did they pass this? Was it a long time ago? Was it in the 1800s or...
Well, Montana had passed this law in the this particular law more recently than that, in reaction to the corruption scandals that the state had seen in the early 20th century. And the idea here is that if the state were to limit expenditures, independent expenditures in campaigns, that that would address the corruption that the state had seen and that had so plagued it in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm. And Montana was pretty vocal in defending, and they continue to be vocal in defending their particular law. I know the governor and the lieutenant governor, the governor being a Democrat and the lieutenant governor a Republican, saying that they're gonna go on to try and get a constitutional amendment here. They feel pretty strongly about the issue.
Well, given their history, they ought to. The state was at one time rife with political corruption, where the influences of mining and natural resources really dominated the politics of the state to an astounding degree. And so the state has a very serious interest in limiting the kind of corruption in the state by whatever means it can. And the means that it chose in this case was to cap expenditures.
Were there other states that also wanted to limit corruption? Is this something that's peculiar to Montana?
No, it's not. Other states do want to limit corruption as well, and we've seen different states try this in different ways. The Supreme Court, for example, ruled last term on a state's effort to limit campaign spending by offering an enticement for candidates to participate in the public financing scheme. And the way the enticement worked was this. You get a lump sum amount from the state to run your publicly financed campaign if you decide to participate in the public financing system. And then if you're running against an opponent who's not in the public financing system, but who spends above a certain amount, a ridiculous amount of money, then the state public financing system would match those expenditures dollar for dollar for the participating candidate. Well, that effort was overturned last term by the Supreme Court on similar First Amendment grounds. And so states are really struggling, trying to find a way here to limit the amount of money in politics and limit the amount of corruption that's going on in the state politics.
Do you think that the members of the Supreme Court were mindful of this Citizens United ruling and had looked carefully at the results of Citizens United? It's early, but there's already been massive, massive expenditures and a whole huge change in the way campaigns are conducted in this country. Did they look at that? They said they don't want to do anything about it, but they must have seen how things have changed.
One would think. Although one would also think that Supreme Court justices going into the Citizens United case would be well aware of the amount of money and influence in politics today. And the majority opinion in that case just doesn't seem to reflect the reality of the influence of big money in contemporary politics. Now, as you suggest, the political landscape has changed significantly in the wake of Citizens United. Most notably, we've seen the advent of these super PACs, which are a direct result of the Citizens United decision. And these super PACs are infusing vast amounts of money, as you and Wisconsin know all too well, into our state politics.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're going to get a better connection here if we can, and welcome your phone calls. I know there's a tremendous amount of interest in this particular issue. There's a lot of interest in what the court's doing this week. We're looking at what they did when it came to restrictions on independent electioneering expenditures, saying essentially it violates the First Amendment, and Montana's law was covered under Citizens United, so they could no longer restrict independent campaign expenditures, even though Montana's had a law on the books for a long, long time because of corruption in the state of Montana. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is Professor Stephen Schwinn, Associate Professor at the John Marshall Law School, and we're talking about the Supreme Court reversing the Anti-Citizens United ruling from Montana. Again, we had a split court on this particular issue. It's a major issue in the country, and it would indicate that things are not going to change unless they're, if, for people who are concerned about this, unless the constitutional amendment route was taken or unless the Supreme Court makeup was changed. Is that a fair reading, Professor Schwinn?
Well, I think that's a fair reading for the time being, with one possible exception. Some states, I began to explain before the break, that some states are really struggling with how to limit the amount of money in their politics. And some states are doing this in clever and creative ways that I think probably will pass constitutional muster, even under the Citizens United decision. And that is when states are encouraging candidates to go out through their public financing system and raise a lot of small donations, those kinds of schemes will probably be upheld.
Well, that's interesting. But that doesn't really take on the huge amounts of money that corporate interests are. I don't understand that.
Well, what it means is that candidates who want to participate in a public financing scheme could be matched by state public financing funds for the amount of money that they go out and raise in small donations. And if they're successful in raising money in small donations, that could yield a sizable campaign war chest for them as part of the public financing system. Mm. That kind of scheme is likely to be upheld even under the Citizens United approach.
But my question is, that doesn't compare to what you can do if you don't do public financing or small donations. You could still outraise 7-1 or 10-1, couldn't you?
You likely could, particularly these days where we're seeing these super PACs raise so, so much money.
Yeah. What a country, huh? What a country. Things are weird.
Well, I'll tell you, part of what's really interesting about the Citizens United case is that it rejected an earlier approach by the Supreme Court, which was not an old approach when the Citizens United case came down. And that approach said that the government had a compelling interest, a really, really important constitutional interest, in basically preventing the distorting effect that massive amounts of money have in politics. And the Supreme Court in Citizens United said, you know, that's not really a compelling government interest. We can't cap independent expenditures to the end of ending that kind of distortion. Well, after Citizens United, I think we've seen that kind of distortion simply explode. And so I do think at some point, maybe it would require reconstitution of the court. Maybe it requires a larger discussion about constitutional amendment. But at some point, I do think we're going to have to rethink this idea that the distorting effect of money in politics isn't a compelling government interest that would allow the government to cap expenditure.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls. Michael in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'd like the professor to comment on the body of cases that has led up to this point, where corporations are really seen to have the true legal rights of a person in the same sense that a natural person has rights, and that if he sees that there are things outside the current court that have led to where we're at right now, maybe say for instance in the body of politics around us.
Michael, those are terrific questions. Let me comment on the idea of corporate personhood first. This is a hotly contested idea. The majority in Citizens United, the 5-justice majority in Citizens United, stated that the First Amendment applied equally to corporations as it did to individual people, just like you and me, citing a string of Supreme Court cases that went back some time. Now, the idea that the Supreme Court has recognized corporate personhood for as long as the majority seems to think is hotly contested. There's been some really good work in this area, and a number of my colleagues have argued quite persuasively that the idea of corporate personhood for free speech purposes is a relatively new invention, if not a completely new invention, in the Citizens United opinion itself. And so this idea of corporate personhood is one of the many sort of bizarre creatures that we see in First Amendment campaign finance law. And there's a dispute about exactly how far back it goes.
Thank you, Michael, for your call. Kathleen in Cross Plains. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to clarify whether or not this covers just local, and whether it includes local and state elections as well as national ones in Montana. So is the Supreme Court telling Montana that they cannot make these rules even for their local and for their state elections?
Hi, Kathleen. Yes, that's basically what the court has said in this case. And the reason why is because the First Amendment Free Speech Clause applies equally to state and local governments in the same way that it applies to Congress.
Okay.
And so when the court's making a ruling under the Free Speech Clause in the First Amendment, first under Citizens United and then under the Montana state campaign law, it applies equally to Montana.
Anything else, Kathleen?
No, that's it.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Steve in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I'm tuning in late, but I'm just wondering if the guest had an opportunity to comment on the decision that came down from the Supreme Court last week that seems, at least in dicta, to weaken the power of public unions to contribute to political events or campaigns by suggesting that an opt-in rather than an opt-out requirement may be required constitutionally, and also limiting the rights of unions to compel payments from free riders.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for that question. That's a really important connection to be making with what the Supreme Court is doing today. And what Steve's referring to is a case that the court ruled on last week that also deals with the speech clause in the First Amendment and the right of unions to be able to assess fees, and in particular special fee assessments, to non-members that would be used either for political purposes for the union or for negotiating bargaining purposes for the union. And in short, the Supreme Court's ruling in that case was I don't know how to describe it other than saying that it was a sharp attack at the union's ability to collect fee assessments by requiring in these special assessments an opt-in of non-members rather than an opt-out for non-members. Practically speaking, what that means is that the unions are hamstrung now in collecting special assessments from non-members. It'll make it very, very difficult for them to do. Is there a connection between this and the Citizens United case? Well, from a free speech perspective, both cases share the court's trend in free speech jurisprudence to allow more speech rather than less speech. And in the union case, really we're talking about associational rights and the right not to associate with organizations that are doing things with which you disagree. And so the court has been jealously protective of these rights. Now, I think there's an important and interesting debate as to whether the court is protecting the right free speech rights. As Michael had asked earlier, do corporations really have speech rights? I think that's an important question. A related important question in the context of campaign financing is money really speech? And so we need to wrestle with all these questions as well. But, Steve, I appreciate your question. It makes a very important connection between two very important cases
mm-hmm.
that have come down recently.
And that decision last week was not at the front of our attention. It was kind of underreported, I think.
Really was, yeah. And that's too bad because, as Steve points out, it's a critically important decision.
Mm-hmm.
It touches on the special assessment. But the language in the opinion seems to apply equally to regular union fee assessments as it does to special assessments. And if the ruling really goes that far, or if the court's willing to extend it that far in a future case, that really will be a hard hit on labor unions.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean? The Montana decision was talked about as a per curiam ruling. What does that mean?
That just means that it's unsigned by an individual justice. It means that it's the opinion of the court
together without the signature or authorship of any individual justice.
Why would they do that?
Well, they might have done it for at least two different reasons here. Sometimes the Supreme Court will issue a per curiam opinion because the case is, in its view, easily dispensable. In other words, it's a pretty easy routine kind of decision and matter, and so they don't need to assign it to a particular justice and go through the formalities of having an individual justice write and sign it. Rather, they can issue it just on behalf of the court. Now, another reason that they might do this is because sometimes the Supreme Court, I certainly would argue that sometimes the Supreme Court doesn't want to reveal who's on the side of a particular opinion. They may be somewhat embarrassed by it politically, or for any other reason may feel like they just don't want to sign their name to it. Now, here it's pretty clear who's on the per curiam side and who's in the dissent.
Yes.
The dissent is signed.
Right.
But those are the reasons that the court would issue a per curiam opinion.
Hmm. Interesting. Steve, thank you. Paul and Slinger, hi.
Hi, good morning. The question I have is, if they have the opt-in for union members, why don't they have an opt-in for shareholders? In other words, I could, you know, own some Union Pacific, or I could own an oil producing company or whatever, and I have absolutely nothing to say if I own 10 shares or 30,000 shares. You know, 10 blocks, the management can with their political ideology, can funnel that money, and I have absolutely nothing to say. And the other one situation is that, you know, right now the Supreme Court ruling is you and I go into the ring with a two-inch Swiss Army knife, and the opposition has a 30-pound battle axe. Now, I mean, it's so distorted that it's beyond comprehension how the justices can came to that conclusion. You know, corporations don't bleed, and they can funnel money because of profits. The union funds are coming from, you know, hourly earners, wage earners, so they have a very finite amount of money they can pony up to PACs or super PACs, what have you.
Professor Schwinn.
Paul, two excellent points. Let me see if I can address them one at a time. First off, with regard to the shareholder opt-in, I really like the connection that you're making here between Citizens United and the Supreme Court's ruling last week on labor unions and the opt-in requirement. I think, you know, personally, I think you're exactly correct. What I think Paul is saying, maybe in somewhat different words, is that in Citizens United, the Supreme Court kind of skated past the interest that when corporations and labor unions are out spending money on politics, they may or may not be representing the will of their shareholders. For these very large corporations, they're likely not representing the will of all their individual shareholders. And yet the shareholders, under the Citizens United ruling, really have no practical recourse, no practical way to tell the corporation that they ought not be spending their money in that way.
Hmm.
One would think that given the ruling last week, the Supreme Court would also say, well, shareholders ought to have an opt-in option to be able to spend in the way the corporation wants to in a political campaign.
Hmm.
It turns out that they used to. Pre-Citizens United, the Bipartisan Campaign Finance Reform Act required corporations who wanted to spend independently in campaigns to establish a separate but affiliated PAC. And then members of the corporation or shareholders in the corporation could donate to the PAC, and the PAC could go out and spend, but the corporation itself couldn't. That's exactly what Citizens United overturned. And that's exactly, I think, what Paul is suggesting is the more sensible option given the court's ruling last week. And this is a real contrast and an important one. I think underscores the court, what a number of folks have argued is a court's bias in favor of large corporations.
So is somebody...
Is
somebody taking that through the legal system now?
Well, we haven't seen a case yet, but we very well may. I think that there are some legal problems applying the reasoning of the court's decision last week to private corporations. And one of the problems just may be that in the case last week, we were talking about public sector unions. In the private corporation context, we're talking about private organizations. Now, certainly there are speech and associational issues with private corporations, but they're not governed and regulated under the First Amendment in exactly the same way. And so if there is a case filed or some sort of follow-up to Paul's idea that the shareholders ought to have an opt-in in parallel to the court's ruling last week, it will probably face some other kinds of obstacles.
Hmm. Oh, we're out of time. Yeah, what a wealth of information you've given us. Thank you so much. I hope you'll join us again, Professor Schwinn.
Oh, I'd love to. Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Professor Stephen Schwinn, he's an associate professor at the John Marshall Law School in Chicago, also an active practitioner, teaches constitutional law, comparative constitutional law, and human rights and lawyering skills. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this hour and to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. A reminder that this Thursday, of course, the decision on the Affordable Care Act and the 10 o'clock hour will be devoted to a discussion of that. Busy week for those Supremes. News is coming up.